they cannot understand the sheer terror when you hear a siren and you know that there are rockets.
We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here we are.
Here I am.
Here I am. With Shy Debbie Dye.
My guest today is Adiel Cohen, an Israeli activist and content creator, and the first Israeli to be interviewed on the Here I Am with Shai David Dai show. So here I am with Adiel Cohen.
What an honor.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Look, Adiel, I have to be honest with you. You know, I prepare quite a bit for every episode. I try to learn as much about people. I don't think I've had a guest that is as mysterious as you. Perfect English,
okay.
But more than perfect English, like perfect cultural references. You are on multiple platforms, on TikTok, on Instagram. You travel the world. You have written op-eds for the Times of Israel and other places. Who are you?
Wow. Okay, so I'm a regular Israeli, born and raised in Ramat Gan. That's my hometown. I recently finished school. I graduated from Tel Aviv University with political science and Middle East history. And for the past 4 years, pretty much, I dedicated my life to creating content and being active for the Jewish community, mostly talking about Jewish identity, Jewish history, Israeli diaspora relations, combating anti-Semitism, Israeli Arab relations. When the Abraham Accords were signed, I became very involved in that as well. And obviously since October 7th, my focus shifted almost completely towards that. I also served for 2 months in Miluim.
In the reserves, yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we're going to get to all of that, and I want to unpack all the content you create, and it really does evolve around everything Jewish, I would say. Other than maybe religious life, you cover everything Jewish.
Sometimes religious life as
well. Although I've seen you write
about
Tisha B'Av, and, but for that, I need to first establish the question that I ask every guest, which is, Adiel, what kind of a Jew are you?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I would say I was raised in like a traditional family. My extended family, a lot of them are religious. I'm Yemenite Jewish on both sides of my family. So, you know, we're pretty traditional in our community.
What does it mean, pretty traditional for you? Because every Jew says traditional, it has very different meaning.
It means, you know, doing kiddush every Friday night, but then sometime, you know, you would turn on the TV or go out after Shabbat meal to like hang out with friends in Tel Aviv or something like that. Judaism and halakha and religion and culture has always been part of my upbringing and my culture and my identity. But, you know, I like to enjoy life. So, traditional.
It's not that being Jewish makes you not enjoy life, but I think you and I and everyone listening will understand exactly what that means.
I hope so, at least.
And you started speaking out, or you started creating content on social media 4 years ago. Before we get to what you create, why did you even start?
It was what I like to call, you know, I became an accidental activist. I didn't come up with this term. Actually, Alexandra Smith from End Jew Hatred in Canada taught me this term, because this is how she describes herself. But it's really what it is. I didn't plan to become an activist. I never wanted to be a content creator or an influencer or like all of that. I was just bored during COVID and I downloaded TikTok just for fun to watch funny videos. And this is how it started, right? I started watching videos, and the way TikTok works, the algorithm kind of tries to understand what you want to see. And then at the time, because I liked stuff about Israel, then it started showing me stuff about Palestine as well, and then some anti-Semitic stuff, because at the time the algorithm was not as developed as it is today. And the more I scrolled through the For You page, the more anti-Semitic content I saw. And
do you remember what kind of content?
Yeah, so everything, all the way from the far right and white supremacists in, you know, America to BDS and pro-Hamas activists. Back then, they weren't as blatant as they are today, but, you know, pro-BDS and anti-Israel, anti-Zionist and all of that. So, and the amount of misinformation was crazy. And there was no one on TikTok at the time to respond. There were maybe three people that I remember that created content about Israel and against anti-Semitism. And at some point, you know, as we say in Hebrew, "Chatafti ta chalastra," like I got, I don't even know.
That? I snapped.
Yeah,
I snapped.
So I said, okay, that's it. Next video I see, I have to respond. And then I started responding to videos.
What do you mean by responding? Like commenting or making?
No, so taking part of the video and making a video response of my own to whatever was said in that video.
What people call like a stitch.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And it started with...
And by the way, I know it sounded so... I just showed how old I am by saying what people call is a stitch. Yeah. But I am. Like, we're not a generation apart, but we're 15 years apart. There's a half a generation between us.
Yeah, and I can definitely say that, like, even the younger Gen Z... I consider myself Gen Z, right? The younger Gen Z, it's like... You know, Shamayim Varetz, like it's a complete difference from, I don't recognize it. You can definitely see the brain rot that TikTok has brought on this generation. But anyway, so it started with this one video of this BDS activist from Canada. And he said, here are three companies that you should boycott because they're complicit in Israeli war crimes. And the companies were HP, the printer company, Sabwa Hummus, and Ben & Jerry's, how not? And when I saw that, I was like, this is ridiculous. So I decided to just respond. And
it is a bit ridiculous because probably like the IDF uses HP printers to print the leaflets telling civilian population to evacuate so they don't hurt civilian
population. See, I haven't even thought about that. Like it's just, it was really that ridiculous. And then I decided to, at first I was kind of making fun of him, which has always been it's been a part of my approach, always making fun of, and like making light of a dark situation. I love, you know, sarcasm and stuff like that. I think it does work in pushing the message forward, but I also decided to bring some information and facts to the video. And I was talking about the SodaStream, SodaStream that used to operate in Balkan, in Judea and Samaria. You had Israelis and Palestinians working there together, side by side, according to what they say, peacefully. And then BDS got this factory to shut down, and hundreds of Palestinians lost their jobs in a day because of BDS.
So just for people that haven't followed attention, SodaStream came into the American consciousness, I don't remember how many years ago, during the NFL halftime advertisement. SodaStream bought like this big advertisement. People started noticing this company, and obviously when people start noticing an Israeli company, BDS, anti-Israel, anti-Semitic organizations start focusing on it as well. So they had their factory in Judea and Shamera, the West Bank. They shut it down and they move it to Rahat.
Right.
Inside of the 67 armistice line. So Palestinians can no longer work in SodaStream.
Yeah.
And, you know, which was an equal opportunity employment for many of them.
Yeah, until this day, by the way, at the factory in Rahat, you have Jews and Bedouins working side by side peacefully. And this is exactly what the BDS movement wants to shut down. So this is why I started talking about it, because I realized that there's so much nuance that people are missing. And at the end of the day, this movement doesn't achieve anything for Palestinians. And of course, it hurts everyone, right? Jews, Palestinians, everyone is hurt by that. So I just wanted to bring the nuance to the table. That's how I started, you know, creating content.
But I'm going to push you a bit and say you were 22 at the time. Most 22-year-olds on TikTok were putting funny cat videos, dance moves, lip syncing. Why this? You could have done other stuff to keep yourself entertained, especially during COVID. Why focus on BDS and anti-Israel and anti-Semitic content where you could just be doing that and probably have more fun and maybe even more followers?
True. I will say this. I am having fun. If I didn't have fun, I wouldn't have done it. Despite, you know, some hardships along the way. But I saw that it works. Like after the first video, again, I didn't plan to be a content creator. I said, let's just make this one video and see what happens. And then I woke up the next day and it went viral. And I realized, okay, there's a potential here to use this platform that is full of, you know, dancing and singing and lip syncing and cat videos. Let's put some educational content out there. If it works, if people like it and it got to the, you know, it really got to a big reach, probably I think at the time 40,000 views for a first video, that's crazy. And I decided to just dedicate my time to that. And every other video that I saw with misinformation, with fake news, I decided to respond to it. And then slowly I also, I found out how anti-Semitism plays. I realized that it's not just like any other type of hatred or discrimination. I could really see how it evolved over the past 4 years and the type of claims that they would bring up. And I remember the first time I was called a white colonizer, which was hilarious to me. And my first response was, how can you call me a white colonizer? My grandparents came from Yemen. And then I was told, okay, then go back to Yemen. So I realized it's not about your skin color. It's not about, you know, where your family spent the diaspora. It doesn't matter where. They could have spent the diaspora in Poland or in Morocco and or in Ethiopia or India. It doesn't matter to anti-Semites. They hate you either way, and they will find a way to show their hatred. And it's been very, very eye-opening. And the more I understood anti-Semitism, the more passionate I became to respond to it and to fight against it.
And your videos, one thing that's clear, there are many, many different people putting out important content out there. One thing that's very, very clear about your content is that it's educational. I assume there's a process behind it. Unless you are some maverick genius that has all this information in your head, and maybe that's true. You mean you studied Middle Eastern studies in Tel Aviv University. But what's your process? You see a video or you see a problem, you want to respond to it in the world. How do you start?
So first of all, I'm a person that is not ashamed to say I don't know. So when I encounter an argument that I don't know how to respond to, or something that I've never heard before, or an accusation against Israel that I've never heard before, the first thing I do is, you know, admit, okay, I don't know. Let's look it up. And then I dig into it and I try to look into as many sources as possible to try to understand this specific issue from different perspectives. I have my own, you know, knowledge, but it's a constant, you know, research that I found myself doing, and just diving deeper and deeper into all these issues that concern us nowadays. Every time I see something that I don't know, I just dive in and I look for the answers. So it takes time. I never put out a video if I don't, if I can't say that I'm 100% sure I have all the facts.
And in this process that you've been doing these educational videos on many, many different issues, and just to like give an example, yesterday I saw a video of yours explaining how the different forces in the Syrian rebel, now the new government forces, are spread between northern Syria, southern Syria, west of the Euphrates River. Like, have you learned anything specific that comes to mind in this 4 years of making educational videos? Something that you didn't even think was like we're missing.
There's so much, because it's like there's so much information and misinformation out there that I can't point to one specific thing that I say, oh wow, like this completely blew my entire existence. It's just the more you dig in, then the more you look into all these issues, and the more you try to understand the Middle East and how Middle Eastern societies work, the easier it becomes to make videos, to feel comfortable and like confident talking about these issues. I can't think of something specific.
But then in recent months, I would say, you've somewhat transitioned from being in front of the camera to going and actually speaking with audiences, speaking mostly with college students, mm-hmm. Around the world. What's that transition been like for you?
It was something that I wanted to do for a long, long time. Like, I really wanted to take my activism outside of social media, and something that I've been doing in different ways before the war. I used to be more active in like peace activism in Israel, but I really wanted to, especially after October 7th, bring the my approach to combating anti-Semitism to young Jewish communities or just Jewish communities in general. And
just explain, what is your approach? You say
so
maybe it's very clear in your mind what your approach is, but I think it will be helpful if you
connect to your Jewish story. Every person in the Jewish community has their own Jewish story, their own upbringing, their own way of connecting to their Jewish identity and practicing Judaism and expressing their Judaism. Connect to that. Connect to your community, your local community, and strengthen the community from within. When we're strong as a community, wherever we are, it's harder for anti-Semites to shake us. I don't think anti-Semitism is something that you can just solve like that. Definitely not, in the foreseeable future. It's kind of like a disease. It's kind of like a virus that keeps mutating, and there are different variants, and every generation they encounter a different type of anti-Semitism. So the best way to, fight a virus is to get vaccinated. And the way you get vaccinated, in my opinion, against anti-Semitism is, get connected to your community, strengthen our communities wherever we are in the diaspora and in Israel, build more bridges between different diaspora communities and between Israel and the diaspora. And the stronger their community is, the harder it is for anti-Semites to, to ruin our day.
and that's what you've been doing. So bringing this approach of connecting people to their Jewish identity, whatever that is for them, how do you do that? What do? You come to a community and then what?
I tell a story. I really do believe in the strength of telling stories. So right after October 7th, when I finished my service, I was called to serve on October 7th, the same day I was already in the base.
Doing what?
I'm a commander in the artillery corps in the rocket division. And I spent 2 months in around the Gaza border and then around the Lebanon border, doing all sorts of missions. And when I finished, the first thing I did, I couldn't just stay at home, be glued to the news and, you know, spiral into an existential crisis. I wanted to be proactive. And I saw everything that's going on social media and on campuses, and I decided to collect everything that I gathered during these 2 months of my service, my footage, the experiences I had, and turn them into a presentation and just go around and tell it to whoever wants to hear what we've been through on October 7th. What did it look like from the first siren to the moment I got to the base and then the 2 months that followed? Just really tell my story and help people connect in their consciousness to a story of an Israeli who was pulled out of school and forced to serve in a war that that was forced on us on October 7th. And it was very successful. And after a year of doing that,
Before we get to that, because I want to stop you and say something really important. Again, one of the things as an Israeli I can really relate to, there are things in our lives that we take for granted, but people from the outside, when they see them, they might not fully understand. You said being taken out of school and called to serve. People have an image of soldiers, right? In the United States, a soldier is a career. That's what you do. You're a soldier, you're a Marine, you're a SEAL, you're whatever you are. You were a student. Last year of your undergraduate degree, you were 25 at the time. You're just going around your life and you were called to serve. And I think that's an important thing. You kind of glossed over it because you take it for granted.
It's true.
But it's not to be taken for granted at all. So then you were traveling, you were telling people that story, and then,
Just, you know, again, just to connect them to in their consciousness to what it means for an Israeli to live through these times on October 7th, you know, how our reality changed, what our reality looked like. I was talking, like, throughout the story I also mentioned, I served with people from as young as 21, just finished the army and were called back. Imagine that, like, we have to serve until the age of 21. They were dismissed, and then October 7th happened, and they find themselves again serving, all the way to 45-year-old fathers who left their families behind, left their careers behind, and came. And mothers, by the way, like, I served in a mixed community, a mixed unit, and, you know, we have men, women, young people who just left everything behind and came to serve because they were called. Now, I said, I used the word forced to serve. We do it happily. Like, we are proud to be able to serve and to protect our country. But the war was forced on us. It's not something that we planned. We all had our lives. We all had our, you know, aspirations. Everyone had their own thing going on in their life. And then we found ourselves, okay, now we have to answer the call and protect our country and protect our people. So I find that when I told that to communities in North America, people's minds are blown. They can't understand that.
Why do you think that is? Why is it so hard for people to understand the experience of living in Israel?
It's a different struggle. I think the same way the average Israeli does not understand the struggles of Jews in the diaspora, the same way happens, you know, vice versa. For American Jews who grew up here their entire life, they may have gone to Jewish schools or not, and, you know, they have their own way of living as Jewish students on college campuses. they have their own struggles, but they don't understand what we go through. It is, you know, American Jews who have never been to Israel or have never lived in Israel through a war, they cannot understand the sheer terror when you hear a siren and you know that there are rockets coming, raining down on you, and you need to go to shelter. And the Iron Dome might miss a rocket, and a rocket might end up falling and killing you. This understanding is something that is basically impossible for anyone who never lived through it. And it's just one example. I can talk about terror, right? In Israel, we are suffering from terror. Just a few months ago, there was a terrible terror attack on the light rail in Tel Aviv, the same light rail that I take almost weekly. It's not something that you can wrap your hand around. It's something that is, you know, beyond our understanding.
Yeah, one thing that I tell people is, and I haven't lived in Israel for almost 15 years. I go twice a year. I spend all the summers in Israel. But even though I haven't lived in Israel for so long, instinctively, when I wait at a bus station, where I wait at a, you know, the side of the road for a friend to pick me up, I look for a betonada, like a cement barricade,
yeah,
just to stand behind, because you never know, like, what if a car tries to ram into the to the bus station? Because there's been many terror attacks that were literally people just using their cars. Terrorists using their cars to drive into civilian population.
Me, for example, like whenever I go to a restaurant or a bar, even here in the States, it became like a habit. I have to always face outwards, like to see the exit.
You're back to the wall, and your eyes to the entrance.
And by the way, in the same way, Israeli Jews cannot understand what it's like to go to school, right, to college, and see a swastika on their dorm room, or see, you know, a mob of students who might go to the same class with them shouting "Long live the Intifada." To the average Israeli, it's something that is almost inconceivable. So I think there are two different struggles, very valid struggles, that we need to bridge between. That's what I've been trying to do.
And then in the past few months, you've, I don't know if you've changed the content of what you're bringing to people when you meet them, or you've complemented this, but you have been doing this thing as part of, I would say, a bigger project of taking back the indigenous narrative.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. What is that?
So I've always spoken about Jewish indigenous rights. I truly believe that we need to speak to, when we want to tell our story to the world, we need to speak in a language that the world understand, specifically the Western world. And when people, you know, when people talk about Jews, they immediately assume, oh, okay, Jews are white colonizers from Europe, and they came on boats in 1948 and kicked the Palestinians out. Like, that's the narrative that I see people believe in. And any Jewish person who is aware of their history and their culture and the journey that led them to where they are cannot accept this. And I believe in, I try to raise awareness for what it means to be Jewish, why we're indigenous to our homeland. What does it mean to be indigenous to the land of Israel, right? We predate every single empire that ruled this land ever. Like, we are the first people that established a sovereign country, state, kingdom in this land. You wherever you go in the land of Israel, you dig 1 meter down and you find layers upon layers of Jewish history. So when people try to say we're white colonizers, it's an attempt to erase our identity. it's not just a war against Israel as a country or as, you know, the Israeli government and their and its policies. It's a war that it's that is meant to erase us from our homeland, from existing. This is why I find it so urgent to speak about, you know, reclaiming the indigenous narrative. I don't really like to use the term narrative, but reclaim our story.
Our story. And part of the way you do it is through the story of your grandmother, Savta Sa'a. And Savta is grandmother in Hebrew. Tell me about Savta Sa'a. Tell me about her story.
So my Savta, she was a very, very strong woman. I grew up with her my entire life. I grew up with her in the same house for 26 years, listening to her stories, listening to, you know, she used to tell me all about Jewish life in Yemen and Jewish Arab relations in Yemen, her journey from Yemen to Israel.
So she was born and raised in Yemen.
Yes.
How old was she when she...
When she made Aliyah, she was 10.
She was 10 years old.
Yeah. So a very, very young
Eagle's
kid.
Wings, the Al-Fan Sharim, which was... Can you explain a little bit about what...
Yeah. So the operation to rescue the Jews of Yemen, she came to Israel with Operation Magic Carpet, also known as Wings of Eagles, which happened in between 1949 to 1951, I'd say. And during this operation, the vast majority of the Jews in Yemen moved to Israel. We're talking about 50,000 Jews living in Yemen at the time, a little bit more. 50,000 came with Operation Magic Carpet to Yemen, pretty much ending Jewish presence in Yemen after more than 2,000 years of living there. And she had to go through all of that.
Why did they come?
Yeah, so I was about to say the operation didn't happen in a vacuum. It followed a crazy rise in anti-Semitism and violent attacks against Jews, blood libels, something that a lot of people don't know. Nazi propaganda made waves not just in Europe, but all over the world, and it made its way into the Arab societies, the Middle East. Mein Kampf became one of the most, you know, popular books. They had a radio station, Radio Berlin, broadcasting from Berlin in Arabic to the Middle East, which led to a very, very difficult life for Jews in these societies. Many times it was like this Nazi propaganda was mixed or like injected with Islamism, and Jews really began to suffer. Jews have never had the best life in the Middle East. Some eras were okay, some eras were not really okay, but the 30s and 40s made it impossible for Jews to live in the Middle East, especially in Yemen and in Iraq, Syria as well. So this is how Operation Magic Carpet happened, thanks to the State of Israel, the newly born State of Israel, and the American Jewish Joint that kind of, you know, operated this entire rescue mission.
So how can you go a little bit into details of the operation itself? Because I personally have a very close family member who came on in the Project Magic Carpet, Operation Magic Carpet, Knafen Sharim. My grandparents had a factory in Kerem HaTimanim in Tel Aviv, so the Yemenites area. So we were surrounded, you know, by people that came from Yemen. The pictures are incredible. So how did they do it? You go to Yemen, like it's a new state, and they go to Yemen to help 50,000 Jews.
It was biblical in its scale and the images that came out of that operation. So, to be honest, I don't know all the details and the politics that were involved in this operation, because my grandma, when she told me this story, she told it from the perspective of a 10-year-old kid. And it's something that, by the way, in my presentation, when I went out and spoke to communities and told her story, I wanted it to remain that. I wanted them to feel how my grandma felt as a 10-year-old kid that had to be evacuated. But it did follow, I would say, the catalyst for the operation, or specifically the departure of Jews from Sana'a, which is where my family is from, the capital city, was a violent pogrom that happened around Hanukkah of 1948, where Jews were completely massacred. They took hostages. They kidnapped men, women. Talking about Arabs from Sana'a who just broke into the Jewish quarter and committed a terrible massacre. In our collective memory, it's remembered as Shabbat al-Dama, the Shabbat of the tears.
Shabbat al-Dama.
Very similar to Hebrew, Shabbat al-Dama'at. And the next day already, Jewish families left. They ran away from Sana'a and headed south towards Aden. Aden, for those who don't know, it's a city, it's a port city on the southern tip of Yemen on the Indian Ocean. Back then, it was controlled by the British, and they knew that from there it would be easier to get to Israel, because the rest of Yemen was completely, underdeveloped. Aden was the only city that had electricity and paved roads and an airport, so they had to go there. And Jews from all over Yemen had to walk. They walked, or they had to ride donkeys or camels all the way to Aden. They gathered there.
What's the distance? Like Sana to Aden? Like, are we talking about like a few hours?
No, we're
Talking a
talking about
few.
a journey of around a week and a half,
A week and a half.
like 10 days. They started with jeeps, like trucks that waited for them and took them away. And then at some point the road ended, so they had to continue by donkeys, with wild animals on the way, with bandits, with we're talking about a very, very underdeveloped country at the time. It was a journey into the unknown, basically. So Jews from all over Yemen, and Sana'a was not the farthest part. Some people came from even north, more north. Some people came from the desert area closer to Oman, all the way to Aden. It's a long, long, tough journey that took a long time. Many Jews did not survive the journey. Some people died on the way. And when they got to the transit camp in Aden, Camp Hashid, that was the name, the conditions were terrible. There was famine. The sanitary conditions were terrible. People died from diseases. People, died in the camp. It was crowded. It was a flash operation. It all happened so fast. Jews
It was
just,
an evacuation.
yeah.
What has been the reaction when you've been traveling around and telling Savta Sarah's story, the story of the Yemenite Jews that had to escape?
A lot of inspiration. I see people really inspired when they hear stories of other Jewish communities that they haven't heard before. It helps them connect to the bigger Jewish story. And it's something that I can say on myself as well. The more I hear about different Jewish communities and the more I learn about the wider Jewish world, the more I feel connected to my own Jewish identity and the bigger Jewish collective. And that's mostly the reaction I see from people. People tell me we had no idea that it happened. Some people didn't even know that there were Jews in Yemen ever. They never heard of this, the
Which
Yemenite
is
Jewish community.
interesting because the Jewish community in Yemen was the first diaspora, or the longest lasting diaspora.
One of the very first diasporas.
That was the first temple that fell in like in 567 or.
And according to our tradition, the first Jews arrived in Yemen even before the first temple was destroyed, because they saw that it was about to be destroyed. They just decided to escape and ended up in Yemen.
And yet many Jews don't even know that that community existed.
Yeah.
But not all reactions were positive. What happened at University of Florida, Gainesville?
That was fun. So they prepared me. I was already in touch with the Hillel fellow there. We became friends when I came to their university with another project. And for this event, he prepared me. He said, okay, we have around 20 people, 20 students that we don't really know their names. They might come as instigators, they might protest, so...
Protest, and just to be clear, you came there to speak about Jewish heritage...
My grandma's story.
Your grandmother's story.
That is all. Nothing about Israel, nothing about the war, nothing about my military service. Talking about my grandma's story of how she was, you know, forced out of her home in Yemen.
And... just by that, that's all people know. They don't even know anything. They know that you're coming to talk about your grandma's story. Already they have about 20 instigators.
Yeah.
Right.
Out of like 100 that signed up. So it wasn't the majority, thankfully. But they made sure to come in on time. They caught all the first rows. And then when I started talking, literally the first sentence, thank you all for coming here, they all... stood up and walked out.
Did they say anything? Did they explain why they're walking out?
No, they just walked out. There was one girl there who pulled out a keffiyeh from her bag, wrapped around the keffiyeh on her shoulders, and said, "Enjoy killing children." And then they just left. That was the big protest that they prepared me for. Looking back, it was just so lame. And
look, I watched the video, and it is lame. It is childish. Mm-hmm. It is...
By the way, it was planned and organized by faculty. It wasn't the students. It was two faculty members.
Interesting. So, so that's something that I didn't know, that faculty would organize, but... What I don't understand, and I was watching the video, and yes, like I understand what's happening in the world in the past 14 months since October 7. What I do not understand is what were they objecting to in what you were talking about? And to be, just to give people a visual, there's a video of what's happening. You were introduced by, I guess, a local student. You're about to speak. The PowerPoint slide already has a picture of, if I'm not mistaken, Yemenite Jews on a plane, and it says Operation
On Wings of Eagles.
On Wings of
the
Eagles.
The story of Savta Sarah.
The story of Savta Sarah. That's it.
Yeah.
So they're either objecting to the fact that Jews are being saved, or objecting to the fact that you're using a Hebrew word. That is the only two things that I can understand, because there's nothing there. They didn't even wait for you to say something that might be offensive or objectionable.
Nothing. And I said it in the video. It's like that's the funny part of that video, because I said, and I really did before the presentation, I was going over the presentation thinking what slide might trigger. No, there's nothing like triggering there. It's just slides. It's illustrations of the stories that I created with AI. So nothing political, purely illustrations of the story. And I went one by one, trying to think which one of these slides might trigger a reaction or a protest. And then when I saw them just leave the moment I started speaking, that's when I said, okay, it's probably just me breathing that's triggering them. And that's what it is. If they're not willing to listen to a Jewish person talking about their heritage, talking about something that is purely cultural, historical, not political at all. I told the, wherever I went, all campuses, I told people, open it up for the public. I don't want it to be just for the Jewish students. I want people to learn. I'm bringing, you know, a piece of history here. And to see that they can't even accept that, it tells you a lot. It's like I said before, it's a war against our existence. It's not about Israel. It's not about the conflict or policies. It's an attempt to erase us and silence our voices.
But what if we had one of the people that stood up and left when you said, thank you for coming, and they were here, and I would have asked them, why did you stand up and leave? Like, you could have chosen not to come at all, but you came in protest. And I'd ask him, what were you protesting? What was so objectionable in Adiel's presentation that you didn't even wait to hear? What do you think they would say?
I honestly have no idea. I think they would immediately deflect and say, well, he was in the IDF or the IOF, the way they like to say, you know, and just resort to calling me a war criminal and you know, empty accusations. I don't think there's anything behind it. Nothing of like substance.
That is, you know, I don't know why my podcast has become the number one depressing podcast on
Spotify. I'm so sorry.
It's not you. It's the world. It's the world. But you're absolutely right. I mean, I want to give people the benefit of the doubt, and I would have loved for them to stay and then explain.
Yeah.
Why they are protesting.
Same. By the way, when they told me...
I want
like
the conversation
their,
to happen.
Yeah. When they told me, you have 20 protesters who are about to like come, I'm like, okay. Like, I don't mind it. I want the conversation to happen. And they told me, okay, but what if they protest? Let's have a conversation. Like, during the talk, I'm all open for it. I'm all about it. And, you know, I... different schools that I went to in the past month.
You don't sound like a war criminal.
I'm not. I'm really nice. I'm a nice person. I'm very polite. I listen to people when they talk to me and when they, you know, show their viewpoint. And then I respond. That's all I want to do. I'm all about the conversation and the discourse. And I had some great, great conversations in the past month. I can, you know, I can just give one example. I was in Concordia the day before the riots happened, like 2 weeks ago. When was it? I don't remember. 2 weeks ago. And we were tabling there with Jewish students, and we invited everyone to come and speak. We held a sign, I'm Israeli, ask me anything.
Let me plug the yeah. student group at Concordia, which just got banned from campus.
I know.
Startup Israel. Yeah. And here's why they got banned from campus. They had me... in September, apparently now I'm suspended from Concordia.
I saw with the cafe and all of yeah. that. Yeah,
which was, by the way, if you think Columbia University is bad, then you don't want to step
Concordia
close
is
to
terrible.
Concordia. Concordia. Then they had Eitan Chitayat, who was wearing a shirt "I'm that Jew" and was protested. And then last week they had Yosef Haddad, an Israeli Arab Christian who served in the IDF, but he's Arab and he's coming to talk about there is no apartheid, and he was, you know, verbally attacked on campus. That was enough to say the only pro-Israel group on campus is pushed out. But I'm glad to hear that you had a positive experience with Concordia.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, they tried to push us out. They took away our table. One of the administrators there, she came and she said, okay, you have to give us the table.
It's hard like, tabling without a table.
Yeah, exactly. So we just stood there. We said, okay, take the table. We're staying here. I have to say that Jewish students at Concordia are absolutely amazing. And we stood there with a sign saying, I'm Israeli, ask me anything. I expected violence. The only thing we got was some jeers from, and I hate to use like, you know, racial profiling, but mostly white kafia wearing students who passed by and, you know, they said like free Palestine and then ran away. And we tried to invite them, like,
did they free Palestine?
Probably not.
Okay.
Not that I know of, at least. and again, I tried to invite them. Come, like, why are you afraid? I'm from Israel. Come speak to me. Of course, no one was willing to listen. Who did come to us? Arab and Muslim students. All the conversations that we had that day were with Arab and Muslim students. I spoke to a group of four Syrians, three of them Christian, one of them was Muslim. We had the best conversation. One Egyptian guy that we ended up being friends, like we follow each other now. The next day he came to my talk, my talk about my grandma. He had the best time and we still keep in touch. A guy from Algeria, two guys from Bangladesh. And it was so meaningful and impactful and real. Like, it was real conversations between people who actually know what they're talking about and have a stake at this, in this conflict or in this region. They were mostly born there. Some of them were raised there most of their lives. And we had such a good time talking to them. We went over time. Like, I was supposed to be there till, let's say, 3 p.m. I left Concordia at 4:30. And it really opened my eyes to some of the forces or some of the people that kind of run the business in this movement. And it just showed me, yeah, like the people who know what what they're talking about, and even, you know, Arabs and Muslims that in our minds we tend to think we have to be enemies, or they think we have to be enemies. I had the best conversations with them.
Yeah.
Of course, it's not all of them, right? The next day we had Hamasniks breaking the windows at the same building, but it was just really amazing, like such an amazing experience.
Yeah, we don't need to be enemies. You know, we don't have to be enemies. All we have is to have a conversation. And it is, on the one hand, maybe obvious that the only people that would have a conversation are the ones that have skin in the game. But maybe it's also ironic that and I agree, what we see on Columbia's campus, what I've seen at other campuses, the white Northern American kafia clad students that have been brainwashed are the ones that refuse to have a conversation or even listen, you know.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
I think it's a lot of it has to do with people who grew up with no purpose and a whole load of white guilt. And they're looking for purpose and they're looking to project their own guilt on something else to show that they actually care and to show that they are on the right side. And they found this very convenient cause that swept the entire world, and you know, they just buy into it and buy into every single part of it, including the anti-Semitism and the erasure of Jewish indigeneity and Jewish history and the call for terror. The day before, by the way, in Montreal, I stayed in like one of the main areas there, the central areas, and all of a sudden I heard screaming on the street. I opened the window and I saw a trans rally, right? It was, I think...
For trans rights?
Yeah, trans rights. I think it was some special day. I'm not really sure. But they were rallying and I was like, oh, okay, trans rally. And I closed the door. I closed the window, went back to bed. And then I heard, long live the Intifada, long live the Intifada. And I jumped out of bed. I opened the window and I see them with a huge trans flag shouting, long live the Intifada. Not even, it wasn't a pro-Palestine rally. It was a pro-trans rights rally. People somehow bought into the idea that Intifada is something that is progressive. And it's really...
What is Intifada?
Intifada is, they would say literally it means to shake off, which it does, literally.
And Mein Kampf literally means my struggle.
My struggle. in reality, in practice, Intifada is nothing but a campaign of terror, bloodthirsty terror against Jews. We had two of these. I grew up, you know, I was a very young kid during the second Intifada. I know what it means. We know what it means. You know, it means bus bombings. It means, you know, sitting at a cafe and being shot to death out of nowhere. Nightclubs, wherever you think of, just bringing terror to every single aspect of life. For years, we lived like that. And to see people who call themselves progressives in the West, who again have no skin in the game, shouting "Long live the Intifada!" I don't know if it's funny or it's sad or concerning or just all of it together. It's just it's unbelievable, and I have no idea how we got to that.
So, instead of focusing on the problem, let's focus on the solution. And I think what you have been doing of creating educational, accessible content for Jews and non-Jews to educate themselves and to use in order to educate other people. I'm sure there are many other people that would want to do the same as you do. What tips would you have for someone young, 22-year-old, when you started, you were 22, and they want to start creating content on social media?
Dive right in. I had no idea what I'm doing when I started doing it. Really, I never created content before. It wasn't my thing. I'm an introvert by nature. Going out there and exposing myself, it's not in my nature. But if you feel like you have this spark in your soul that calls you to take actions, take it and get connected. That's one thing. The second thing, I would have never been able to do it if it wasn't for the community. Get connected with the community. There's a huge, nowadays, it's not like 2020. There's a huge community of creators and activists who all care about Jewish rights and fighting anti-Semitism and the betterment of the, you know, the Jewish people. Connect with them, send them messages. Just immerse yourself in this community, get inspired by them, and slowly but surely it will become a lot more, you know, a lot easier. It'll come naturally.
Great. Dive right in, or as Nike says, just do it.
Yeah.
I love it. all right, so Adiel, I end every episode with what I've been calling a Jewish lightning round. It's a series of questions, very quick questions. There's no right or wrong answer.
Okay. It's
the first thing that comes to mind. You get one pass, and I get to tell you if you get that pass.
How many are there?
I haven't counted. We'll count at the end.
all right.
Okay, Adiel Cohen,
yes.
What is one thing people don't know about you?
Oof. Why do people not know about me? I've never thought of it because I've never thought of sharing it with people, like sharing stuff that people don't know about me. I don't know why this question threw me off. Why do people not know about me?
That's okay. I can give you a pass. We can.
It's really stupid. I don't drink coffee. I'm the only Israeli that doesn't drink coffee. It's nothing much, but it's, you know, off the top of my head.
That's a good point. Okay. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
I mean, I wish more people knew. Some people know we're indigenous to our homeland. We're indigenous to Israel. We are indigenous people in our essence.
What is your favorite curse? Hebrew, English, Yemenite.
you gave me Yemenite. It's good. I will say, it's very obvious. Zion. I say Zion all the time. I try to refrain from saying Zion, but I say
Zion is dick.
It means dick, but you say it when you're like, okay, you're like Zion. As yeah, when you're when you're annoyed, you say as a Zion. When you're surprised, you say Zion. You know, like you just say it.
It's so interesting.
It's very useful.
I never used that word.
Really?
I never used that word.
It's so useful.
Interesting.
Someone tells you something that is surprising you, like Zion.
When was the last time you cried?
Yesterday.
What happened?
Whoa. You put me on the spot. So I don't cry a lot, but when I cry, I love it. I love crying. Because it's really like it calms you down. So every year I get into this birthday blues. I'm a January kid. My birthdays have always been rainy, gray. They've never been a fun occasion for me. I mean, sure, like I had fun. I met with friends. We had a little party.
When's your birthday?
January 28th. And but it's mostly the way I see it, and I'm okay with it. It's a day for like self-reflection. And then yesterday, I heard this one song that I don't know why it triggered me into thinking about my birthday and growing up, and this, you know, just the thought of growing up, when I'm in the right mood or like the wrong mood, it can make me cry.
Wow.
Yeah.
You don't know what's ahead. I'll tell you this. If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Wow. Can I say two? Okay. One, Maimonides, the Rambam. The Yemeni Jewish community has a very special connection with the Rambam for
letter
reasons that, yeah.
Like letter to the Yemenites.
Exactly. I can go into it for hours, but generally we have a very special connection with him. I would love to hear him speak, like just words of wisdom. The second one is late Israeli poet Naomi Shemer. She's one of my favorite people in our history, in our heritage. Her demeanor was so calm, and her words, the lyrics of the poems that she wrote were so, you know, so deep. I just want to hear her speak and share ideas.
Well, you can't have her because she's dead, but you could have her son, Ariel Horowitz, who, you know, is a musician. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
I don't want to be annoying. I don't have a favorite Jewish holiday. I think all Jewish holidays come in the exact right time. Chanukah for, you know, the winter vibe with the sufganiyot and the candle lighting. But then you have Purim. You get dressed and you go get drunk. Sukkot, you build a sukkah and you decorate it with, you know, with your dad. Every Jewish holiday has its own magic. I think, I'll say this. Sukkot has a special kind of magic that other holidays don't. That's it. I said it.
This is going to make the next question really, really difficult.
Okay.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
I wouldn't say like it's not my, okay. Not bad, right? It's just my least favorite, Shavuot. It's like, okay, you know? Yeah, and I'm lactose intolerant, so come on.
Okay, that's explained. Shavuot is all about eating dairy. Okay, I get it. When do you feel safest?
When I'm in Israel at home with my parents.
When do you feel least safe?
When I hate to say it because I used to feel safe. I used to come here all the time to New York. My sister lives here. I used to feel very safe in the city. In the past year, I've been trying to avoid the city as long as I could.
What gives you hope?
Our history. Our history. Just looking at our history and how much we've been through.
What is the first thing that comes to mind when you think of the words Jewish civil rights?
Indigenous. People need to understand that. I can't stress this enough.
And finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
Zaka.
Say more.
Zaka are, that's
Z-A-K-A.
The...
Z-A-K-A.
Yeah, that's the organization or the body that... they're the first responders. They go to every crime scene, every terror scene, everywhere there's casualties, and they are the first ones to witness the horrors. They were the first ones to, you know, go there on October 7th to the kibbutzim, to the Nova, and do the just terrible, terrible job of taking care of the bodies and making sure every single Jew is brought to Kvura Kshera, and every single human, because not just Jews were killed on October 7th, every single human is brought to their grave fully. Yeah, Zaka.
Adiel, where can people find you?
Adiel of Israel on all platforms, Instagram, TikTok.
Can you spell that for people?
Yes, it's Adiel, A-D-I-E-L, of Israel. O-F-I-S-R-A-E-L. On TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and recently YouTube.
All right. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Is Savta Sarah still with us?
No. She passed away earlier this year, which made this entire tour even more emotional.
I am just so glad that you had a grandmother like her. She did well. I hope every Jew can have someone like that in their lives. And more important, I hope every Jew can be that someone for someone else in their lives.
Man, yeah.
And I'm just very grateful for you for being here. And here I am with Adiel Cohen.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."